Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Authors on the Air. I'm Pam Stack, your host. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tonight is a very special episode. It is an in-conversation program tonight with two very, very special guests, whom I'm honored to call friends as well. Moderating tonight's show is James Ziskin, and his guest is Jennifer Kinchelow. I'd like to bring on James Ziskin first to talk a little bit about him. For those of you who don't know about Jim, he writes some magnificent mystery thrillers. I'm going to just bring him on and let's talk. Jim Ziskin, welcome back to Authors on the Air.
Thank you, Pam. Great to be here.
I have to say, your stunning victories, not stunning to anybody else, but a dual victory at BoucherCon this year must make you very proud. Congratulations on winning the McCavity and the Anthony Awards. Let's talk about that.
Thank you.
How did you feel?
Well, I'm still just absolutely thrilled and kind of still can't believe it when I think back. And, you know, with so many great writers and so many great books, and you know, I'd been nominated a couple of times before, and those, you know, somebody else won, and I always just felt great for those people. But I can tell you, when they do call your name or your book, it's an amazing feeling. So I think I sat there for 5 or 10 seconds when they called my name for the McCavity for the best historical,
right?
Because I just really with the other the books, and I also just felt, you know, I just didn't have any expectations because my books are set in the early 1960s. And
right.
I think, you know, a lot of people, or myself included, did not really think of those as, you know, that historical. I mean, I guess the older they are, to me, it seems they're more historical, but I suppose that's not really the case. You know, they're still like 55, 56 years old, the action that takes place in these books. So I was just blown away and just so honored and thrilled.
Who called your name for the McCavity?
For the McCavity, it was Janet Rudolph.
Oh,
and
good.
Actually, I remember that so clearly. She didn't call my name first. She read the name of the book first, which is oddly a different, an unexpected thing. I guess I was expecting to hear somebody's name, and certainly I was not expecting to hear mine. But when she said Heart of Stone, which is the book that did win that, I was just stunned. And I was sitting with Susanna Calkins and with Katrina McPherson and some other friends, and Susie and Katrina were nominated in the same category, and they are just the most wonderful friends and talented authors. They stood up and gave me a big hug, and it was just, you know, they couldn't have been happier for me, which was really moving and just, you know, just reminds you how great the people are in this business. In our business.
It's really true. It's a beautiful tribe, that's for sure. And who called your name for the Anthony?
For the Anthony, it was, I believe, I was sitting way in the back. I think it was Twist Phelan. No, it was Lucinda Serber. It was Lucinda and Stan. And I was really in the back of the room, and it took about 5 minutes to make my way up to the podium.
Did you have something prepared?
As we sat at the McCavity ceremony, Susie insisted that she said, "Look, somebody's going to win, and we don't want to forget anyone." So she just scribbled down, you know, names, and I thought that's a very good idea. And so she handed it to me, and I just added, you know, my agent and my publisher and things like that to add in terms of people to thank. But that was all it was. It was just to thank my fellow nominees by name and my publisher, my agent, and my wife.
How wonderful. Congratulations on your success.
Thank you.
It is my understanding that you are now writing book number 6.
Yes, I've just recently finished it, and I'm on the second revision, and it should be going. I like to revise it 2 times before I first send it to my editor. So it should be later this week, I think, it will go to my editor. And the book is due out next summer, June the 5th, and it's entitled A Stone's Throw.
Excellent. Doesn't it seem like a long way off once you get it to editing and it moves forward to the publisher? I know that they have these things timed, but are you Are you already thinking about book number 7?
Yes, as a matter of fact. I don't have much of the plot down, but I do have the setting, and that's going to be a big surprise. So I can't talk about that yet. But
okay.
But you're right. When you're finishing the first draft, it feels like it's about to be published any day now. And then once you finish that, it feels like forever until it comes out.
Right. Well, the deadline makes you feel like you have to hurry up and get it out, right?
Exactly.
and then you hurry up and wait. So, well, good for you. I hope that you'll come back when your book is released and tell us about it. But in the meantime, you brought somebody special with you today to talk to us. And you want to talk to us about your guest?
Sure. I'm here today with Jennifer Kinchlow to talk about her new book, which comes out tomorrow, The Woman in the Camphor Trunk, and the camphor as in C-A-M-P-H-O-R. I'll say it carefully, Camphor Trump. Trunk, sorry. And it's the second Anna Blank mystery, and we're going to talk a lot about Anna today and about the book and about her first book and... So the first one came out a year ago, or a little more than, a year and a half ago, maybe. 2 years ago. And that was The Secret Life of Anna Blank. And these are historical mysteries set in 1907, 1908, that era, Los Angeles. And just fascinating reads, and we're going to get into that in a minute. But first, I can just introduce Jen. Jennifer Kinchlow is the award-winning author of one of my personal favorite series, the Anna Blank books. And I can say without lying, Anna is my favorite series lead character. She is absolutely adorable. And I've, really fallen for her like a ton of bricks. So I loved her in the first book, and I think it's just even better in the second. She's even better. So I was lucky enough, Jennifer asked me to blurb the first book, and I was honored to have my modest words on the cover of on the back cover of that book, The Secret Life of Anna Blank. And that book was a finalist for the McCavity Award, the Sue Fetter Historical Memorial Historical Award in 2016, and it was also a finalist for the Lefty for Best Historical Mystery of 2016. Or for 2016. It was, I think, for 2015, technically. She's also won the Colorado Gold Award for Mystery. I believe that was for an unpublished version of
right.
The Secret Life of Anna Blank. And she won the Mystery and Mayhem Award for Historical Mystery. She has been a researcher. She's at the UCLA Center for Health Policy. She is a PhD from UCLA. She currently spends most of her time in jail in Denver, Colorado, where she's doing research for the Denver County Jail or
Sheriff's Department. Yeah.
Yeah, Sheriff's Department. So Jennifer grew up in Los Angeles or around Los Angeles in that area, where her Anna Blank novels are set. You grew up a little later than the books than the period when the books are set, though.
First of all,
I just wanted to congratulate you on the new book, which releases tomorrow.
Thank you.
And so I'm going to ask you, Jen, if you could give us, just to start off, the elevator pitch or, just a brief, kind of resume of the story of the woman in the camphor trunk.
Sure. It's based on a couple of true stories that I got out of the newspapers that I like to read newspapers from the 1900s to get story ideas. And the first was a story in New York about a 19-year-old missionary woman whose body was found stuffed in the trunk of her in the apartment of her Chinese lover in Chinatown. So I kind of took that story and fictionalized it. And then there was another story about two Chinese slave girls who were stolen away from one Tong leader. So Chinese gangs are called Tongs. and by the leader of another tong, and they were rival gangs, and it caused enormous tension, and they were kind of poised on the verge of war. And the former owner offered a $1,000 reward for the return of his slave girls, and the LAPD was hunting the girls so that they could give them back to their owner and collect the reward and also avert a tong war. But it just seems so sordid that I just have to write about it. So
the police were actually playing along and were going to return two women back into slavery for money.
That is according to the newspaper article.
Yeah. Reading your books, you know, it has that little bit of a feel of the Wild West still in 1907. You know, you still have Los Angeles. It's not at all like the Los Angeles of today, except maybe some of the weather. But, you know, you've got the horse stables beneath the police station. You've got a lot of horses and muddy streets. And the speed limit is 10 miles an hour for the few automobiles that are around. It's really a fascinating portrait of a city that you paint.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm fascinated by those details. So I go to great pains to learn all of those little facts and get it right so that I could create an atmosphere, because I really love Los Angeles. And this book is kind of the tribute to L.A., and I want to get it right.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing you neglected to mention in your talk about in your little resume of the plot is your heroine who works for the Los Angeles Police Department as an assistant matron, or as the assistant matron, I guess, and one of the first two, at least in your fictional world, and she somehow contrives and manages to get involved in the investigation, and it's a lot of It's fun, but it's also at the same time it's very serious as well. But can you tell us about the whole matron situation and what they used to do and what Anna's situation is?
Sure. Yeah. So Anna is a young woman. She's 19. She is the daughter of one of the wealthiest men in Los Angeles, and she has been disowned by her father for getting a job as a police matron with the LAPD. So the police matrons were sort of the beginning of women in law enforcement. And Los Angeles had had one for maybe 20 years. And these women dealt with women and children who were involved in the criminal justice system. So they watched over women in the jails to make sure they weren't being abused. They interrogated female suspects and questioned female witnesses. They also helped, you know, they helped with investigations. Anytime women and children were involved, they did searches for missing persons. They did a lot. And the women who tended to hold these positions were pretty amazing, capable, brilliant women.
I see. And so Anna becomes one of these matrons, and her boss is, you know, conveniently whisked out of town for a family emergency for long enough to keep her from, you know, keeping an eye on Anna. So Anna gets to get involved in this investigation in this book. So I would like to talk a little bit, since we're discussing, you know, her position. Also, let's talk a little bit about Anna, because I alluded to how I think she's my favorite character in any recurring series right now. She's so smart, yet you know, she is how would I like to describe her? She's like this combination of innocence and spunk, beauty and intelligence. She's adorable and she's maddening, because you can't control her, and she just wants to do things, and she puts herself in danger, you know, at the drop of a hat. And so these are the things that I really love about her. She's also very funny. The books, I haven't mentioned it yet, but these books are incredibly funny. There are moments of farce. There are just moments of really hilarious sexual tension. and you know, that really works well with the whole innocent side of this young woman. And I want to talk more about the sex in a bit, not the sex, but the sexual side of this thing. But what can you tell us more about Anna and her background? I mean, you've mentioned that she's the, you know, the poor little rich girl who's now been disowned by her father, and so she's all alone and working and struggling for a living. She's living in a tiny apartment with all of her belongings that don't fit, but she has no money.
That's right. Right. Anna, as I was writing, you know, what's the impact of sexism on women, and what would happen if you took this really smart, sort of ambitious, energetic girl and just clamped down on her and wouldn't let her do anything, and, you know, she never got to go anywhere. She was a decoration. She had to look perfect at all times. Her father was trying to marry her well, so, you know, for financial gain. And she manages to escape that, but she doesn't really escape sort of the impact of that on her development. So Anna has a big arc. She's got a lot of growing to do. But I think that's what makes her so interesting and sometimes endearing, that she's still quite naive, but that's she's losing that. And
yeah.
She's, you know, she's been incredibly sheltered. She does not know anything about sex. And you know, it wasn't – I read to research the book, one of the things I did was read manuals for young women, for young wives. They did not talk about sex. But one of the things the book did say is that a lot of girls go into marriage not knowing anything about sex. So I thought, well, you know, I think that's believable. Anna lost her mother. I just can't see her dad sitting her down and having the talk. So she's very innocent, and she's a little bit self-absorbed because she's been waited on her whole life. And so I think all these things – but she's brilliant. She's ridiculously smart, and she has a hunger for knowledge. And so that's Anna.
And she's fearless. And she was raised in a convent, I mean, was her education, so they weren't going to teach her about sex either. So, and yet she still kind of has, on more than one occasion, mentions how she would rather have her love interest, the man that she's in love with at least, she longs to feel his hand on her bottom instead of imagining his hand on some other woman's bottom. And she mentions it two or three times, I think. So there is an awakening happening in Anna, obviously. And also you mentioned her naivete. I just wanted to quote one brilliant line that was so funny. I laughed out loud many times, but this one, it's at the very climax of the book. And I don't believe it gives anything away if I just say that there's like a riot going on, and there's these marauding rioters, men, you know, running amok, and she is supposed to distract them for reasons that the reader can find out when they read the book. And the way she does it is by saying good evening, shouting at them, good evening, I'm a prostitute. Because, well, I can let the reader find out why it has to be a prostitute and not someone else, but it works, you know. And so she even like lifts her pantaloons just to show 3 inches of shin or something, you know, and she bats her eyelashes. So she's very, very funny and doesn't really understand what, you know, what this is about or what a prostitute, I mean, she knows what a prostitute does, but she wouldn't certainly
sort
know
of.
How to do it herself. And also, you know, and just in terms of the sex, which is, and again, it's very innocent and very, very endearing, you know, her curiosity and her, you know, wanting to learn and wanting to experience things, but she does have a knack for, in this book at least, for ending up in various stages of undress in front of the man that she loves, but cannot have. So, you know, including one scene where she's totally naked in the dark and covered in honey, But again, we'll let the readers find that one out for themselves. And it's just something. But that led me to wonder, and I wanted to ask you, you know, how do you deal with that, you know, the putting off of, you know, that kind of sexual tension and prolonging it, and how, you know, what is your vision of the longings that she has as a young woman for this very handsome police officer, Joe? And that's no secret. They knew each other in the first book as well.
Oh, gosh. You know what? I think about it all the time. Like, I'm working on book three now in the Anna Blanc series. So I'm struggling with what direction I can take. I have, like, three different paths that I can go, and I'm trying to figure that out. So they say, you know, once your characters sleep together, the tension's gone and it's all over. But I love this series by Elizabeth Peters, the Amelia Peabody series. Mm-hmm. And the first in the series, I don't know if you've read it, but she's an Egyptologist at the end of the 19th century. And it's a hilarious book, and it's kind of a romance, and it's kind of a mystery. And she, at the end of the book, she gets together with the guy. And for the rest of the series, which is like, I don't know, 17 books, they're married, and it's still super funny.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's that way to go. It can be done. And then I wonder sometimes, you know, is Anna going to settle down? Or
yeah.
Am I going to take this in a new direction?
Here's the something, too. I mean, you know, you've got obviously, like, Nick and Nora were married, and they still had, you know, cute sexual tension, not tension maybe, between them. Obviously, Harriet Vane and Lord Peter Wimsey, and they ended up getting married, and that was brilliant. So you could certainly continue in those along those lines. What I love about Anna is that she already is making her own way. I mean, and you know, she is with the police. She is investigating, even though she's maybe overstepping her, you know, it's above her pay grade, so to speak. But
yep.
She is investigating and solving crimes and doing an amazing job and becoming a notorious, you know, woman at the same time with her pictures in the newspapers, you know, and everyone writes her love letters because she's so beautiful and adorable. So, but that, I think you could go certainly down that road. What was the other road you were saying?
So there's a road where they get married, or there's a road where she finds some, you know, they break up, and then she explores other relationships. Or there's the road where, you know, they stay unmarried but sort of, you know, primary love interest each other. So I don't know what road I'm taking. And the book that I'm writing is unfolding, and we'll just see what happens. I just
Jen,
do
you plot your stories out ahead of time, and you're at that stage, or do you? Is it a mix of flying by the seat of your pants and plotting? How do you plan out your stories?
Well, I started out writing screenplays, and so I use like the save the cat, plot out your screenplay is what I do first. So that's like creating a three-act structure, and then I start writing. And I find I usually rewrite the first section of the book a million times, and that's when I start to find out what people are feeling, how they're relating to each other, where things are going, and then I continue forward, and you know, it has a ripple effect and impacts the ending. So I've written about 2/3 of this next book, and the parts that I've written are pretty well hashed out.
Mm-hmm.
And I know how it ends, but I have this gap where between the ending and between where I'm at now, that I'm still I'm kind of pantsing it. So,
yeah. Well,
yeah.
Sometimes it's a combination of both, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, speaking of beginnings, because you just mentioned it, the opening of The Woman in the Camphor Trunk, I think it provides some of the most remarkable imagery that I can remember in a crime novel. And it's Anna running down the Long Beach Strand with the severed head of a Chinese man in a tin pail. And she's being pursued by a Long Beach police officer, but because she's stolen the head. And it's just, it's farcical and it's horrifying at the same time. And I think that a lot of your humor in your books really works with that dynamic, that that twisted sense of humor of yours, which you don't find very often in crime fiction. You do find it sometimes, but I love the way you play, you know, like the farcical with the tragic, and manage to, you know, make it work. Speaking of that severed head, I love this passage, and I think it illustrates some of your most powerful writing, the way you do it. And it's also very typical, or exemplary at least, of your writing, where Anna and Joe, near the beginning of the book, are trying to get rid of this head because, you know, nothing good is going to come of it being discovered on her. So they dump it in the river. And there's a scene between them, because there's this incredible tension since the last book of them being, you know, kind of in love with each other. And if I can just read this very short bit, I think it really shows how you play this beautifully. So Anna kissed him until he kissed her back. Her kiss was melting fiery and burned with all the intensity of their situation and all the passion required to overcome it, his pain, her scars, their abandonment, and a severed head floating down the river, which is just brilliant. So I just have
Thank
to congratulate you.
You
on lines like that. It's just this beautiful and really, you know, hitting it on the head, you know, their emotions and what they are struggling with. And, of course, there's this comical and tragic image of this head floating down the river that they've just, you know, gotten rid of. So. So tell us about your humor and your wicked sense of humor, of, because it's in your narrator as well. You do a third person omniscient narrator, but you sense that the narrator has some of Anna's attitudes or, you know, views, that they seem to bleed through.
Yes, my narrator is almost Anna, and I do, yeah, very close, person close. My humor, I don't think I could write a serious book, and I don't know why that is, but I started out writing this, it was a screenplay at the time, The Secret Life of Anna Blanc, you know, kind of as a tribute to this police matron who's a historical figure who's just very sober-minded, and she was, you know, a political powerhouse, and she was brave, and she accomplished all this stuff. And I'm sitting down to write this, and like Anna Blanc comes out and all her silliness and all the absurdity of her situation. And I don't know why, but I don't think I can write serious.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, I enjoy very much the relief that a little bit of humor, and I think you've got quite a bit of humor in the books, but it's not entirely. This isn't just like a you know, humorous novel. They're not just humorous novels. That you have a very serious side in both of them. But I think that as a reader, I appreciate that. I appreciate just the ability to, you know, that's how humans cope with tragedy, is with, you know, sometimes with a little humor. And it lets a little of the air out of the tire when you're reading something that is, you know, your heart is beating, and sometimes it's hard to read that for an entire book because you're exhausted by the end. This gives you a little respite.
I mean, the book deals a lot with racism, which is very serious.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk to you about the Chinese and the Chinese white, dichotomy that you have in the book, because the book takes place in Chinatown, all of the action and all of this happens there. And so you tiptoe really that whole racial the line very, very well, because, you know, you want to write a believable character, but you don't want to make her a bigot, obviously, and she's not. But there is a divide between the Chinese and the whites, and there's incredible violence against the Chinese when the whites get angry, like if there's a scandal with a woman who has two Chinese men as lovers, or if she's murdered by a Chinese man, and you even, you know, deal with, for example, you know, the kind of the appropriate slurs of the time. Your characters use Chinaman quite often in their speech. Your narrator doesn't, I don't believe. I think your narrator uses Chinese. But that was the word that was in currency at that time. So tell us about
right.
the racial lines and how you navigated those in this book.
Well, I had a steep learning curve when it came to racism and in general and racism against the Chinese. So I had no idea about the kinds of violence they experienced and the way they were viewed. So we have stereotypes about Chinese people today, and they're things like they're, you know, computer geniuses, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, some sexual stereotypes about Asian women, and those are bad. But the stereotypes in the 1900s were totally different. You know, there was the stereotype that Chinese men would seduce weak-willed white women, you know, with their opium mm-hmm. and their – that they were oversexed. You know, they were just viewed as oversexed. And it was so strange. So strange. But so I try to showcase the stereotypes that the Chinese face, you know, that they ate rats and they – you know, that they were dirty and that they were all kinds of things, but really, you know, there was no basis for it.
Right. And I think another very effective thing in the book was just how insular that community was for a variety of reasons. For example, they, you know, the laws were against them. They couldn't own property or they couldn't marry a white woman, but also that they didn't speak English. I mean, in this community, some of them speak a little English or some speak English, but so many of them were living as if Chinatown, you know, in this country for many, many years and still just never needed anything but Chinese, or Mandarin or Cantonese, whatever they're speaking.
Yeah, I mean, it's
so how did you deal with the language issues, and did you do any particular research?
So they would be speaking dialects that were, like, related to Cantonese. So, I have a friend, another author, Matthew Borison, who wrote The Girl with the Ghost Eyes. If you guys missed that, that came out the same day The Secret Life of Anna Blanc came out. And it's wonderful. It's set in late 19th century Chinatown, San Francisco. And he's kind of a Chinatown scholar, and he helped me out a lot. And I did a lot of reading to try and figure out sort of what's what and what was going on. And language was a barrier for me because the, you know, I use the newspapers a lot and eyewitness accounts. And
yeah.
Those were in English. There was a Chinese language newspaper, but I don't think anyone's ever translated it. So language was a problem for me in my research. And, you know, I think in Chinatown there were people who interface with the white world who were quite fluent in English, and there were some people who were maybe newer and never had a conversation
yeah.
with a white person.
Yeah. Yeah, and then there's a lot of that, and obviously Anna has to overcome that as she investigates the murder of this woman found in a trunk. Very, it seems to me, very accurate and brutal description, by the way, of the body in the trunk, and I think you did that very well.
Thank you.
There's no need to sugarcoat what a dead body looks like after 9 days, and even though in old movies, of course, you know, they look daisy fresh, you know, and as if nothing had happened. But the reality is quite different, I'm sure. So, you know what, speaking of language, let's move to English then on this, where this book is concerned. And you know, I was struck immediately just by the title of the book, which I think is a great title, and it evokes immediately a time gone by, just the word camphor. To me, that just says old time. I don't know anyone who has a camphor trunk today. Maybe some people do, but you know, I remember cedar closets and things like that, you know, from my youth. And these are the kind of things that evoke, in with just one word, kind of this image of the past. And I think you do a great job of that in the book with many other examples. You know, and I've talked about these in the past since I write things in the more immediate past. But I refer to them as my Madeleines, like as in Proust, and these little words that conjure up, you know, an image of the past, and instantly and kind of almost magically. And I think that camphor does that. You use a lot of other old words, but can you talk about the research maybe that you did into the, you know, the vocabulary or the words of the time or the spirit of
sure.
the time?
Yeah, and I just did a blog post that just came out today on the language that, because I did a lot of research. One of the things I would do, I mentioned before, was read the newspaper, which had a lot of slang in it, and also just ways of saying things and ways of spelling things. And I read novels and textbooks and anything I could get my hands on from that period. So things Anna would have read.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was kind of a little bit, you know, over the top on my details. Like, okay, well, what would a young girl Anna's age call a dress? Well, she'd call it a frock, you know. And I got
mm-hmm.
that from slang the teenagers used in a mystery novel that I read, you know, that Anna would have read from her day. So I did a lot of work on that. And I have the Dictionary of American Slang, which Historical Dictionary of American Slang, which has two volumes. They're enormous, and it stops at the letter O. But you can look up words to see, were they using that then? And,
yeah.
you know, when did it first appear in print? So that's quite a resource.
Yeah, I think that's important, you know, if you don't want to break the spell, you know, of your historical, you know, novel, you don't want to throw in a word that didn't come into use until later, obviously. But even very subtle differences, I noticed your use of the term make love or making love. And you're using
right.
it in the older sense in the book, which I think is correct, where it just meant to, like, pitch and woo, and
right.
it didn't mean to engage in, you know, coitus. So
right.
at least not in every example, I think. But that kind of care is very interesting. I also, you know, noticed some really charming words that you came up with, and you must have picked those up from books or from your reading and research. Just the slang of the time, like words like mall buzzers, M-O-L-L, buzzers, which are what, men who harass women, I think, if that's what I've understood it to be, right?
Yeah, and I got those. I picked them out of, you know, out of newspaper articles, and I mean, I just harvested them and then tried to figure out what they meant, or tried to, you know, learn from context. So.
And then there was treat girl is another one.
There's
a young woman who is, I forget, never appears in the book. It's Anna's assignment to find her, and never she gets busy with this murder investigation. There are nice euphemisms like manly weakness when Anna, you know, is speculating about some drug or something that the Chinese, you know, apothecary or the, you know, is selling, you know, concoctions for, like, manly weakness. High binders are they like the hatchet men?
Yeah, they're the thugs in the Chinese gangs. And they were
the term,
really feared, and there was just a lot of hype around them.
Yeah, and the term hatchet men comes from these gangs, is that right? Because they would
mm-hmm.
wield hatchets. Yeah, sing-song girls; those are the slave girls that are at the heart of this whole, you know, mystery that where it begins, the kidnapping of these slave girls, and sing-song.
Right.
I assume because they were entertainers as well, or.
You know,
or, I don't know.
Probably, and some of them were musicians, but I thought that was just all over the newspaper and all over. That was a really common
yeah.
term. So I think.
Well, and it also can be a euphemism for something, as in, you know, which is so what makes Anna's pronouncement so stark, so funny when she says, "I'm a prostitute." you know, as if a prostitute would need to announce herself. But also, you know, she has words that I think have become quite beloved among her readers, your readers, her mild oaths. Anna says she uses the word, you know, the expression Jupiter quite a bit, you know, when she's excited, or biscuits, which is, I think, my favorite. When it's like, damn it, you know, but it's, she says biscuits. And are there any other good, any other oaths that we don't, that I'm not thinking of that Anna might use?
Oh, gosh. I'll have to think.
There was one, taffy.
Taffy, yeah, that's taffy.
Is that like
would
bull?
Be like bullshit.
And
even saying something like geez, you know, even like a mild oath, that, you know, biscuits, you're not supposed to say that because that conjures a bad word. So, like, the truly well-mannered person will never exclaim, you know,
I remember my grandmother was against people saying geez because she said what it really means is Jesus. And,
that's right.
You know, and even though it isn't, yeah, absolutely. And then you bring up a lot of just the, you know, cultural and, you know, just things that were around back then, like, you know, cranking the car before you started or setting the crank or whatever.
Right.
You know, that things like Cracker Jack boxes. I'm not sure why Anna is she's got a huge supply of Cracker Jack because she has no money, I know, but that's what she's surviving on throughout the book. That and Kippers and whiskey, which is great. but these are great little, you know, Cracker Jack was a big deal, and I really love, there's a great scene between, you know, Anna and Joe in the book, where they ask each other riddles from the Cracker Jack boxes, and it's just a very touching scene between them, and it tells you so much about them as well. So, you know, I just think congratulations on those touches like that really bring the book and the period to life.
Thank you. Yeah, and I got those right out of, you know, those are real Cracker Jack riddles from the 1900s. So
really,
I didn't know those.
I wanted to take
a moment, if I could, please, to say if anyone wants to call in and say hello to Jennifer or to Jim Ziskin, please do. We're on the air for about 15 more minutes. The number is 347-633-9609. That's 347-633-9609. Man, I tell you what, Jim, you are a good interviewer, and Jennifer is always your great guest. You're doing great.
It's crazy, Pam, with this book and with Jen. It really is.
It's true.
And
I agree with you.
I wanted to do something slightly different and ask Jennifer a couple of trivia questions about her book.
Oh, no. Let's see if I can remember.
To see if she can answer them. And then we'll discuss. So the first question is, I wanted to ask you, do you know how many different patron saints Anna invokes in this book?
No, do you?
No, I don't. I didn't. You know what? If I had had an e-copy, I would have counted them. But there are so many. It's so funny because every time something happens, she will say a prayer to the patron saint of this, to the patron saint of that, you know, of lost things, of lost people, of policemen, the patron saint of virgins. And it you know, obviously speaks to her upbringing, her very Catholic upbringing by the by the nuns. And so I could ask you about that, and I will in a minute, maybe a little bit about her her upbringing. I mean, her Catholicism. But okay, another question I had was, do you know how many different hats she wears in this book?
No.
It must be 10. It must be. I mean, she's constantly putting on a new hat and then losing it, despite the hat pins. Somehow the hat gets ruined or it gets, you know, wet or something. All right, another one, just last one for the trivia question then. And this also bears on her Catholic upbringing. At one point, she's feeling very down because of her romantic situation, and she wishes she were dead. But she says she would never kill herself because she's a Catholic, and so therefore she must wait for death to come either from old age or what other cause?
To get hit by a trolley.
Yeah, being hit by a trolley or something. So this gives you, it just shows you Anna's, you know, the whimsy, and I just love that about her. Like, yeah, or I'd have to wait till I grow old and die or get hit by a trolley or something. So, and the trolley sets us in the period, which is nice. You know, we don't see trolleys anymore in Los Angeles, obviously. You talk about the red cars, I think, which were everywhere in those days. And so, again, I just love the humor that comes out, her, what's inside of her, you know, that humor. And at the same time, you manage to fit it into the time period, which is really, really a good trick. So, okay, well, you got one out of three. Okay, so I did mention the Catholicism, and I think I might have discussed this with you once before, you know, just maybe at a conference. But, you know, Anna is part of her, you know, innocence and naivete that she was brought up so conservatively. But did we discuss her convent upbringing?
No, and one of the things that I'm doing with that there, it's so funny because somebody who read the book left a review on Amazon or something saying like that this novel was a religious novel, proselytizing novel, which I thought was so interesting because like my whole thing with Anna was that her spirituality was so shallow. Like she didn't get, I don't think she really got Catholicism, right? She's just
right.
Looking at it on a really surfacey level where she's negotiating with God and bargaining for stuff, and she's really driven by fear of punishment and the desire to get stuff. So I think her spirituality is a little funny. Like, there's humor in that, that almost misunderstanding of her own faith.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm kind of playing with that. And at the same time, Anna's very much sort of a, you know, out-of-the-box thinker, and she has this belief system on one hand, and she's trying to, you know, walk that fine line to get what she wants or feels like she needs to do without getting, you know, punished for it. So
yeah, and she also, I mean, it doesn't give anything away, I believe, but at one point she makes a kind of a very, you know, harmless crack about Presbyterians, or she doesn't quite.
That
rescuing someone from the gangs and maybe perhaps putting them with these Presbyterians that wanted to save them is another form of slavery. After all, they're Presbyterians, you know. And it's just a very innocent and fun, and I hope harmless little comment from Anna, but
from someone who was raised Presbyterian, and also her love interest is Presbyterian, so.
Yes, and yes, that's true, and she can score points off him, you know, with that, and with telling him that he when she's angry at him that he's not very good looking and he's poor. Also, he's poor. You know. So, I got into a little trouble with one of my cousins in my last book when one of the characters said, well, you know, that my family were. Methodists from Southern Illinois, and they wouldn't understand this character being gay. And my cousin said, "Hey, we're not like that." And I just said, "No, okay." You know, I didn't mean anything by it. But I wanted to ask you, if there's a call, we can take a call. But
you're good right now. But you're down to 5 minutes, so
okay.
Just want to let you know.
I wanted to ask Jen about her experience with Seventh Street Books. We're both published by Seventh Street Books. And about her experience with them and with the editorial staff, in particular Dan Mayer, who's the managing editor, and even the other editors, the line editors and the proofreaders.
Oh, you know, my experience has been incredible. I love Seventh Street Books. I feel like I haven't run into any of these horror stories that I hear from other authors about things that have happened. You know, I feel like Seventh Street really supports me. They promote my books. I have a great publicist, you know, who works really hard and is on top of everything. I love Dan Mayer. I feel like he gets the book. He gets my books. And
yeah.
I never, you know, he's a light touch, and sometimes I get a little nervous.
I wanted to ask you, does he give you copious notes, or is it, how does he do it?
Oh, gosh, he changed nothing substantive at all in my last book, which made me a little nervous. But also, I'll have to say, before I've worked on these books for years before Dan sees them, and they've already gone through two of my friends who are editors, and been workshopped in, you know, writers groups, and and I've rewritten them 1,000 times, so they're pretty tight. I don't know that my third book is going to get such a, and we'll see. You know, I'm trying to write faster this time, and so I don't know if this one might be in a little rougher shape, but so I don't know. I mean, it's hard to really compare across books. A lot of people get more content support, but I've gotten a lot of content support before it ever sees Dan. So
yeah, and did I hear that this book that you changed the title somewhere along the line?
Yeah,
or
I did. Yeah, I changed the title. It was going to be The Secret Death of Elizabeth Bonser, who's the name of the woman who's in the trunk.
Yeah.
It's also the name of my former agent. So as a tribute,
wow.
I killed her and stuck her in the trunk. And but it kind of put me in a tight spot. Like, I really can't come up with a lot of names like that. I mean, you know, with your series, you work stone in, and that's pretty easy. But The Secret, I don't know. That's just, it was hard. So,
no, you're right. And I know that, I think there was some talk about including her, you know, having the title resemble the other title, so that, but I think this is a wonderful title that you've ended up with. I don't know if it was you or somebody at 7th Street, but I think it's a great title, and as long as it says an Anna Blank mystery, I'm going to buy the book and read it. So,
yeah, I love the title. I think it's much better. And we had a brainstorming session on our 7th Street Book Authors Facebook page. I don't know if you were part of that. People were throwing ideas at me. And so, but I happen to know that Chinese trunks are often made of camphor. So there you have it. I'm really happy with the title.
And what's next before Pam cuts us off? Do you have a title for the next book or a tentative title?
Griffith Park. That's the working title. Griffith Park.
And
it's hard to talk about this book and this next book because there's so many surprises up front that I'm like, oh, gosh, how are we going to handle this? But I'm sure I'll get some good advice from 7th Street. But I'm not really talking too much about the plot at this point. But it is based on stories from the newspaper. So.
Well, I spent many, many, many hours in Griffith Park in Los Angeles. It was near our house when I was in L.A., and love Griffith Park. So that's a beautiful setting, and it's a huge setting. You've got all kinds of different terrain. You can probably do something really fascinating with it. I'm sure you will.
I love Griffith Park, too. So I love L.A. I love exploring subcultures and places in this historical place, Los Angeles. It's just fascinating for me, so... Yeah, Griffith Park.
And is there any other...
I want to take a second to just say something.
Sure, go ahead.
I have had such a good time listening to both of you, and I've actually learned so much about interviewing just listening to you. So thank you so much, Jim Ziskin, McCavity and Anthony Award winner for Heart of Stone, Jennifer Kinchlow, award-winning author for The Secret Life of Anna Blank and the new book, The Woman in the Camphor Trunk. I'm so happy that you were with me. Will you you both have to come back. Maybe not together, but you both have to come back when the next books are out. Promise.
Absolutely promise. With pleasure.
Absolutely. And thank you, Jim. You are a tremendous interviewer.
No, oh, Jennifer, I loved your book. I loved the first one. This one is going to be a huge success. It is. Anyone listening, please do yourself a favor. This book is, it's a wonderful romp. It's deep and it's funny, and you'll love it.
Jim, will you
please tell
everyone where to find you? Where's the best place to look for information about you and your books?
Either my website, which is jameswziskin.com, or if you look up even Jim Ziskin, it should show up on Google. And then on Facebook, I'm at, you know, it's James Ziskin. I'm there. So that's a good place
and
to find
Jennifer?
Me.
Jennifer Cicillo, author on Facebook. Jen Kinchelow on Twitter. JenniferKinchelow.com is my website.
Will you please spell your last name just so everybody understands there's an extra E in there?
Sure. KinCheloe.
There you go. And if you have a hard time finding either one of them, just go to Amazon because you'll see their names in lots of stars after both of their books. James Ziskin and Jennifer Kinchelow, thank you so much for being with me tonight. I adore you both, and I look forward to seeing
you
next year at several conferences.
Thank you, Pam.
Have a great night. Good night.
You too, Pam. Thanks, Jen.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
And that's
Bye-bye.
Our show for tonight, folks. Tomorrow night, I'll be talking to Greg Barth, who has a new book out called The Bloodletting. It is kind of a noir western. I can't wait to talk to Greg about it. I hope you'll join us. Thanks for being with me, and thanks for Mom and Dad. Good night.